This is a CBC podcast. The Sundance Film Festival was all abuzz after the world premiere of the documentary Payback, the adaptation of Margaret Atwood's book of the same name. But have you heard the Massey lectures that inspired them both? Buy Payback, Debt and the Shadow Side of Wealth now at cbc.ca/iTunes.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas, about the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle.
Blind faith in illusions is our culture's secular version of being born again. These illusions assure us that happiness and success is our birthright. They tell us that our catastrophic collapse is not permanent. They promise that pain...
This is American writer Chris Hedges, reading from his 2009 book, Empire of Illusion. In it, Chris Hedges explores how the United States, and by implication Canada, has become a culture hooked on illusions of literacy and wisdom and happiness. These illusions keep it from confronting a vast array of serious social problems. Ancient Rome used to offer up bread and circuses to keep its population distracted, but Chris Hedges believes our illusions are subtler and even more dangerous. Chris Hedges is a senior fellow at the Nation Institute and a lecturer. He spent almost 20 years as a foreign correspondent in war zones around the world and won a Pulitzer Prize for his work with the New York Times. He's also the author of the bestsellers War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and American Fascists.
The culture of illusion, one of happy thoughts, manipulated emotions, and trust in the beneficence of power, means we sing along with a chorus, or are instantly disappeared from view, like the losers on a reality show.
The CBC's Jim Brown went to Chris Hedges' home in Princeton, New Jersey. They sat on the front porch and talked about our empire of illusion.
So I think there's something fitting about the fact that a book about the end of literacy and the triumph of spectacle actually begins in a wrestling ring. Tell us, first of all, how the old sort of Cold War narrative of wrestling with the Russian bad guys and the Middle Eastern bad guys, how has that evolved to fit our new post-Cold War era?
It's evolved quite dramatically, because in the old narrative of popular culture, of which professional wrestling was a part, the world was bifurcated into the good and the bad. The virtuous American and the evil Russian. There was a delineation between us and them. And these figures have evolved over the last few decades to present another narrative of personal disintegration, a narrative where there are no rules, where authority is always to be defied, so that prisoners who suffer post-traumatic stress disorder and appear in the ring in their orange jumpsuits to take out their vengeance upon the prison guards, infidelity, it's a constant theme now, parents that were cruel to their children, that the disintegration within American society is reflected within the wrestling ring. In the narratives in the ring, including one wrestler who gets wiped out in the 2008 meltdown and loses all of his retirement and pension savings funds and then becomes enslaved to a Wall Street tycoon. It's quite fascinating to watch how these narratives accurately reflect what's happening, especially within the working class within the United States. And that, of course, is part of its appeal, because these groups within the United States have been rendered powerless. And one of the things that surprised me attending professional wrestling events was the passion of the crowd, the people screaming and crying, and because I think that their fantasies of revenge are played out in the ring, and the attraction, I think much of the attraction is that outside of the arena, these people are completely beaten, and they have they have no way to respond other than through essentially a fantasy life.
So the hatred that was once turned outward is now being turned inward.
Yeah.
If it was focused before out there on the big Russian bear or the evil Japanese
right.
jujitsu expert or the Iranian sheik,
right.
it's now being focused here at the evil at home.
Yes, and it's not only being focused at the evil at home, but it reflects, I think, a complete disintegration of any kind of moral code. However, that code may have been an ideal and an unrealized ideal, at least existed. You know, there was a wrestler named Captain America. But, I mean, these kinds of older figures in the arena, they would never cheat. They always played fair.
The bad guys cheated.
The bad guys cheated, but not the good American. Now everyone cheats. Now everybody is abused. Now everybody is angry. Now everybody seeks vengeance. And I think that reflects, in part, this kind of narcissism within this culture, because what it really is saying is that we're all victims. Everybody's become a victim. And in that victimhood, or in that kind of cult of the self, of which victimhood, of course, is an integral manifestation of the cult of the self, you have a right not only to get whatever you want, but to make all of those forces that have victimized you suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the narrative now in the ring is about. I mean, it's a narrative that, of course, is beyond professional wrestling. It's something you see in reality television and all sorts of popular culture venues. But professional wrestling does it pretty well. That's why they make so much money.
Now, you suggest that there are messages for the spectators about the inherent fairness or unfairness of the system outside the wrestling ring. What do you think these narratives and the buy-in that you see from the crowd suggests about the way that wrestling spectators, and I guess in broader audiences, have come to view morality in our own lives?
Well, I think it's an accurate reflection of the breakdown of the moral order, because the breakdown of the political system is at its core a breakdown of morality. It's the inability for the weak and the vulnerable to be heard. It is the escalating assault on the working and the middle class, and they have no mechanisms now within the political structure in which they can fight back. So I think it's an accurate reflection of the powerlessness now of most people within American society, and these people know it. The anger that they exhibit towards authority figures is not a misplaced anger. They have a right to be enraged. They have been betrayed. And popular culture becomes a very good mirror to hold up and look at those emotions, because popular culture is only able to sustain itself to the extent that it caters to those emotions. I mean, popular culture is, as opposed to, you know, what you might call authentic culture, it's not transformative. It doesn't seek to transform. It doesn't seek to raise you to another level. It's not about introspection or self-criticism. It's about emotional highs and emotional lows, and catering to those emotional highs and lows. And so I think that that it's a reflection of a very frightening transformation within American society, from one that, when the system functioned, made piecemeal or incremental reform possible, and now, in essence, has shut that safety valve, that kind of reform is no longer possible. It doesn't matter what citizens want. And there's just example after example of that. I mean, nobody wanted the first bailout bill, $700 billion passed on to Wall Street, and constituent calls were 100-1 against it across the political spectrum. But it passes anyway, because the financial services industry control the political process.
You quote the American historian Daniel Boorstein in your book, and he's writing about how the fabricated has come to replace the real. And he writes, "We risk being the first people in history to have been able to make their illusions so vivid, so persuasive, so realistic that they can live in them, We are the most illusioned people on earth, yet we dare not become disillusioned because our illusions are the very house in which we live. They are our news, our heroes, our adventure, our forms of art, our very experience. What does it mean to you when Burstein writes, our illusions are the very house in which we live?
Well, it means we're utterly, him and he's right, we are utterly, and that's what's so frightening about where we are, we're utterly disconnected from the real. The belief that we are going to restore the economic prosperity of the 1950s into the 1960s. The belief that we can continue forever to borrow, to maintain both an empire and a level of consumption that we can no longer afford. The belief that we are the best at everything. We have the best healthcare. We have the best educational system. When, of course, coal statistics, for whatever they're worth, demonstrate that that's not true. The whole reconfiguration of American society into a kind of neo-feudalistic state, an oligarchic state with masters and serfs. Two-thirds of this country now really beginning to suffer economically. And yet we have the illusion of the American dream. And the fact that the wealthiest among us, from Donald Trump to Warren Buffett, are treated as sages within the culture, I think are all evidence of a deeply self-deluded nation that has unplugged itself from the real. And you know, Borstein's right on that.
I guess there's another part of the delusion as well, the fact that so many people seem to be living their lives as if they're the stars of their own movie, you know, acting like the celebrities that they see on television or in films or magazines, imagining how an audience would react to the events in their own lives.
Well, there you go. That's Facebook. I mean, that's it, you know.
Well, what happens if you're living that kind of life when you actually do confront reality?
Well, we've created quite effective systems of electronic hallucinations where people can divorce themselves completely from reality. And they spend all of their time in self-presentation. So, of course, what that is an utter destruction of any kind of authenticity and the primacy of illusion. I mean, that's what celebrity... It's why celebrities have such disastrous, often, such disastrous personal lives, because being a celebrity, in essence, means you have no idea who you are. You can't disentangle that public presentation. And that's what gets them into so much trouble, and in fact, finally, so much misery. But I think that's sort of writ large now throughout the culture, because we've created electronic mechanisms whereby everybody can at least posture as celebrities. And that has, again, been an effective technique by which communities disintegrate and individuals become increasingly atomized. When you sit alone in your room in front of a screen, you're alone. And that is all the great writers of totalitarianism, from Hannah Arendt to Karl Popper to Fritz Stern, others have pointed out, is one of the preconditions for totalitarianism, that atomization of individuals, one from the other.
Do you get the sense that celebrity obsession and celebrity posturing has replaced religion in our lives, or the function that religion used to perform in our lives?
To the extent that religion provided narratives or stories or myths by which we reflected on human reality, yes. But I would also say that religious institutions have become as infected with the disease of the cult of the self and the self-delusion as every other institution. So that successful, and if you want to define successful in terms of a popular following and financial resources, successful religious institutions have just imbibed the most pernicious elements of celebrity culture, so that their top proponents, figures like T.D. Jakes or Joel Osteen, are in their own right celebrities. Pat Robertson, I mean, and not only are they celebrities, but they make celebrity money, hundreds of millions of dollars. Pat Robertson, we don't know, is estimated to be worth anywhere between $500 to $1 billion. So I think that not only has the culture of illusion, as I think you correctly point out, not only does it function in the way that traditional religious systems function, but I think those religious systems that have the highest profile do so because they have perverted the Christian religion so that they are in accord with these values, if you want to call them values. I mean, and the biggest lie that's sort of sold to us through this embrace of illusion is that reality is never an impediment to what we want, that we can have everything we desire, that all we have to do is focus on happiness or dig deep within ourselves and find our inner strengths or believe that Jesus and God carries out miracles and it'll all happen. And that's sold to us across the cultural, political, and religious spectrum, whether it's by Oprah or positive psychologists or the Christian right or Hollywood or the corporate state.
So given all of what you've described, what is the effect of all of this on just simply and basically our understanding of what is true?
Well, I mean, all of this is accompanied by the death of the print-based culture. And this confusion of the brought about by images. We confuse how we are made to feel with knowledge. The people who disseminate these images are very skillful and very good. And the severance from print, of course, illiteracy rates just alone are high. And there's, interestingly enough, as high in Canada as they are in the United States. But then there's a kind of willful illiteracy, people who are functionally literate. They can read, but they don't. And that transformation from a print-based culture to an image-based culture, especially when the vast majority of those images are manufactured, controlled, and disseminated by corporations, makes it very hard for us to see truth. And totalitarian states are always image-based states. That's the one thing they're really good at, spectacle and image. And that's what the corporate state is very good at, spectacle and image. So, you know, I used to wonder, was Orwell right or was Huxley right? Well, it turns out in a funny kind of way they were both right. I mean, first we got Huxley with mindless amusements and diversions and while we were stripped of power. And as the G20 proved, then we get Orwell.
In an essay from the 1960s, the German sociologist and philosopher Theodor Adorno outlined what he believed to be the essential steps we needed to take if we were to avoid another Holocaust. And he began it by writing, "The premier demand upon all education is that Auschwitz not happen again." What was Adorno most afraid of?
Educational systems that did not train people or give them the capacity to make moral choice. Educational systems that placed an emphasis on rote learning rather than critical thinking.
Now, in her final book, Dark Age Ahead, Jane Jacobs wrote about how education has essentially turned into credentialing. And she drew a distinction between an education where the goal was learning, where cheating basically didn't make any sense, and today's system, which is about receiving a certificate, which will allow you to escape a low-wage job. And under that system, teachers and tests essentially become obstacles that need to be overcome. So I'm wondering how much that credentialing of the education system feeds into the problems that you're talking about.
It's quite an effective form of control in the sense that when you get to these elite institutions, you have never been permitted to make a mistake. You are so carefully packaged, both in terms of your test scores, your grades, your extracurricular activities, that you build a student clientele who is not only abjectly deferential to authority, but allows itself to define its worth by what authority thinks of it. So at the elite institutions in the United States, you get highly capable, driven, and disciplined students who are weak. They're subservient. You've weeded out all the iconoclasts, all the rebels, all the people with any kind of fierce independence. They are effectively weeded out of that system. So they never even make it, by and large. They don't make it into these schools. And I think that when you look at where all of these people go upon graduation, it confirms my point. We have a situation here in Princeton where $500 million was given to the Wilson School, which is the School for Public Service. And all of the graduates are running off to Wall Street. They're not in fact, the family that gave the money has been suing the university to try and get it back. So I despair. And you know, I teach these kids and I like them, and many of them even have a conscience. But they don't have the spine to stand up to these systems of authority. And indeed, they are, almost without exception, seduced into these primarily financial systems of power.
You talk about rebels not enrolling at universities. What about on the faculty side? When we used to be able to count on one or two iconoclasts within each faculty, you detail students, in a sense, acting like whistleblowers whenever they hear some kind of message from a professor that strays from the straight line they're looking for.
Well, there aren't many professors left who will ever stray, and what they've done, of course, is retreat into obscure academic jargon and focus all of their research on the most tangential and often ridiculous subjects, which get them published. And it's all this kind of treadmill towards tenure. And the process itself effectively weeds out anyone who might cause problems for the system itself.
Why hasn't it weeded out you yet?
Well, because I don't get tenure. I come and go as a visiting. I come and go and get visiting professorships, but I'm not clubbable.
Now, you make a direct connection between what you call the bankruptcy of our economic and political systems and the funding cuts and neglect of the humanities. Make that link for us.
Well, the humanities are designed to teach people how to think critically, how to make moral decisions, how to question structures and assumptions. And when it works, it is a subversive endeavor. All true intellectuals are subversives because they're asking the kinds of questions and pointing out the kinds of inconsistencies, challenging the myths, all of the illusions that are peddled by systems of power. And that's why totalitarian states are so frightened of intellectuals, who always remain relatively powerless within those systems, but whose criticism, which, because of course they speak with a kind of truth, the state recognizes correctly as dangerous. And I think the corporate systems of power have very effectively marginalized. I mean, look at the economics departments, for instance, within the United States. If you didn't pay complete loyalty to laissez-faire capitalism in almost any economics department anywhere in this country, you couldn't get tenure, couldn't get a job. And yet, I bet if we went over and looked at the economics textbooks that are being handed out, even at the, as we speak, to these students, it's totally divorced from the reality we live in. How do you teach laissez-faire capitalism when we've had the largest transference of wealth upwards in American history, courtesy of the American taxpayer? And you have this bizarre phenomena where you teach dead ideas that are utterly discredited by the reality around you.
You write about happiness in your book. You have an entire chapter devoted to happiness. But what you're writing about really is conformity and compliance in the guise of happiness. Describe how practitioners of positive psychology are being employed to inculcate a sense of conformity in our corporations and other organizations.
It's a very pernicious ideology because it posits that there's nothing wrong with the outside environment. There's always something wrong with you if you're not happy and cheerful and upbeat and optimistic. And this is leached into every aspect of society. So that if you're poor or sick, or if the cancer that was in remission comes back, and you're not positive and upbeat and optimistic and happy, there's something wrong with you. So it has the twin effect of disempowering people in terms of responding to actual injustices, abuses, alienation, and at the same time discrediting those people who don't chant from this ridiculous mantra. And this kind of cheerful optimism, which is really what drives corporatism forward, reduces everyone to the level of about a 12-year-old. And it's what got us into so much trouble in the first place. The inability to see reality, the naive belief that technology or science or inevitable human progress will intercede to save us is irresponsible and self-deluded. And yet that has become the, you know, to the extent that America has an ideology, that has become its ideology.
So if we're all being told that happiness is achievable in all of us, in all situations, what happens to those of us who are not happy?
We become viewed as obstructionists, people who get in the way of progress, who get in the way of corporate advancement, who aren't on the team, aren't part of the family. I used to work for the New York Times, and they would always send out emails, even at the New York Times, although, of course, it's a Fortune 500 company, about the New York Times family. And it's pretty amazing how many people buy into it. So it again becomes an effective way of weeding out people who refuse to conform.
You write that America has become a facade. It's become the greatest illusion in a culture of illusions. How has America become a facade?
Because of who we think we are, where we think we're going, what we think we're doing, and who we really are, and where we're really going, and what we're actually doing. The disconnect is seismic.
Now, some people might question whether the America that you remember ever really existed. Are you concerned at all that you could be creating the same kind of false nostalgia that the Tea Party, for example, employs in pushing its agenda?
No, because I was very careful to try and list the deep failings of America towards African Americans, towards the poor. But I think there is a fundamental difference from the America that I grew up in and the America that exists now, and that difference is this. We had a system by which incremental or piecemeal reform was possible. We had liberal institutions. Now, these institutions existed because they set very narrow parameters that the power elite accepted. For instance, you could criticize the war in Vietnam, but you could never criticize the intentions of the war makers. You could challenge inequities or injustices within a capitalist democracy, but you could never question capitalism. And the pillars of the liberal establishment, which were tolerated and even rewarded by the power elite, acted as a kind of safety valve. So that in the 1930s, when capitalism breaks down, you have traditional liberals like Roosevelt or Henry Wallace as vice president who institute the New Deal. And Conrad Black, when he writes his biography of Roosevelt correctly, says that Roosevelt's greatest achievement is that he saved capitalism. You have the civil rights movement, which allows a traditional liberal wing of the Democratic Party to push through the Voting Rights Act of 1964. Now those liberal institutions no longer function. There is no way to redress the injustices and grievances that are being visited on a larger and larger percentage of the American population as we reconfigure ourselves into a neo-feudal system, an oligarchic system with a thin class of obscenely rich and powerful, a small managerial class, which is really what, if you graduate from Princeton, you end up going to do. And then about two-thirds of the country that are living in conditions that are approaching subsistence level. And their grievances have no way to be redressed through the system. So when I talk about the America that was and the America that is, I don't in any way want to idealize what was. But I would say that it had mechanisms built into the formal structures of power that served as correctives. And those mechanisms have ossified. They no longer work. They've closed shut.
Now, the facades that you write about take the form of unacknowledged bankruptcies. And the most prominent among those is the literal bankruptcy facing the American economy right now. How has corporate America used the techniques of illusion that you write about in your book to both define and protect itself?
Well, it narrows the parameter of debate. So you can't have a rational discussion about serious issues. The healthcare debate. I mean, we have studies done by Physicians for National Health Plan out of Harvard that have made it clear that if we abolished corporate control of healthcare, I think the savings are around $400 billion a year. I mean, it's staggering. But their research, which is disinterested, I mean, these people are doctors. They're not trying to sell us drugs or anything. Never made it into the debate at all. They were completely locked out.
And I guess your argument is that because the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies wouldn't allow them to take part in the debate.
Yeah, they don't allow them, or you have media institutions like the New York Times that are so heavily dependent upon their advertising that they aren't about to challenge them in any meaningful way because they don't want to lose the money that they depend on for survival. And the networks are even worse. I mean, at least there's some, I think, ethic that remains at the New York Times that's completely devoid now from commercial media. But that's a small example. I mean, there's innumerable examples. So you're not even allowed to have a real discussion. I mean, the freak weather patterns that have beset this country. We have serious climate scientists who have been predicting these freak weather patterns for some, and it's all disconnected. There's no pattern. There's no relevance. There's no. I mean, the debate now about global warming is reduced to essentially two equally self-deluded tracks. One is that global warming doesn't exist, and the other is that we can all adapt. So we can continue to pump carbon emissions in the atmosphere a staggering rate, and we'll just all adapt. We'll plant palm trees in Chicago as if that there's ever going to be a finite point. I mean, so just in terms of the environmental catastrophe, we're sitting around committing collective suicide, and our options are to deny that it's happening or to believe that we'll all accommodate ourselves to it. You know, it's an acceptable range of opinion from A to B, and that's it.
We tend, I think, as a society, to link democracy with capitalism. We sort of think that democracy and free markets necessarily and naturally go hand in hand. But you argue that they're, in fact, antagonistic entities. Why?
Well, because capitalism is not about the fostering or creation of the common good. It's not about community. It's not about giving all segments of your society an equal voice. There's nothing egalitarian about capitalism. And unfettered or unregulated capitalism, as Karl Marx understood, is a revolutionary force because it turns everything into a commodity that you exploit until exhaustion or collapse. So the natural world becomes a commodity. Human beings become commodities. And these societies, as Carl Pugliani pointed out in The Great Transformation, essentially unregulated, unfettered capitalist societies, commit self-annihilation. They destroy themselves because they know no limits. It's always about short-term profit and the expense of human capital or natural capital over the long term. Any kind of sustainability, both of the nation state and the ecosystem, is not relevant, and that's the age we live in. We live in unfettered capitalism as a revolutionary force, and that gets back to, I think, the point I made earlier, or that Nader had made to me, that it's the radicals who have power, and it's those of us who call for the rule of law, the traditional conservatives, who have been turned into the political pariahs.
Let's talk about worst-case scenarios. You write that our way of life is over. What's your greatest fear when it comes to the future?
That economic and environmental catastrophe converge, and that the longer we remain self-deluded, the less prepared we are for it emotionally, intellectually, psychologically. And because we don't understand the processes that have brought us to this point, we do what confused populations have done throughout history, which is search for scapegoats. Muslims, undocumented workers, homosexuals, intellectuals, and you vent your fury and your rage on them. And I think that if you look at the rhetoric of the lunatic fringe of the American political establishment, and it's, I guess, fringe is the wrong word. I mean, if you look at the lunatics who have a real shot, people like Rick Perry, at becoming president, then, you know, we're not far away from this.
The worst case scenario demagogue could already be on the scene.
Sheldon Wolin, who's probably our greatest living political philosopher, in his book Democracy Incorporated, describes what the system we're living under as inverted totalitarianism. And by that, he means it's not classical totalitarianism. It doesn't find its expression through a demagogue or a charismatic leader, but through the anonymity of the corporate state. That in classical totalitarian regimes, you have this charismatic figure and a party that whether it's reactionary or revolutionary, that overthrows a decaying structure and replaces it. In inverted totalitarianism, you have corporate forces that purport to pay fealty to electoral politics, the Constitution, the iconography and language of American patriotism, and yet have so corrupted or seized internally the levers of power as to render the citizen impotent. And I think that's right. Now, in Wolin's book, he says that the two most effective forms of control of rendering the population passive are access to credit and cheap mass-produced goods. Well, the credit's already dried up. for certainly working class, poor, and even middle class Americans. And those cheap manufactured goods are not as so cheap anymore, especially food. Commodity prices, wheat has increased by 100% the last 8 months. So I called Wolin, who's retired in California, and I asked him, so if you remove those two mechanisms of control, if people don't have access to credit and they don't have access to the cheap goods produced by the consumer society, could you flip? Could you flip from a system of inverted totalitarianism into a system that more closely resembles classical totalitarianism? And he said yes. So I think the description that best fits the American political system is inverted totalitarianism, but I don't think it precludes, especially if we suffer a currency collapse, a system that more closely resembles classical totalitarianism.
I'd like to hear your thoughts on what you think it's going to take to pull out of this.
Well, human behavior usually doesn't change. People respond not to the reality around them, but they respond in the ways they've been conditioned to respond. And if you ask me to lay money down, I would say that human behavior won't change until it's forced to change. So we will continue to be enthralled by the bread and circus that's tossed before us. Cicero wrote about this quite eloquently, the end of the Roman Empire. The spectacle consumed civil and political discourse. And we all remember what happened to Cicero. He was captured by Mark Antony. He was beheaded and his hands were cut off, and the severed head and the hands were taken to the arena. And the crowd was told he'll never write or speak again. 40,000 people roared their approval.
A friend told you he didn't know if you were a journalist or a preacher.
Right.
What do you think?
Oh, I'm a preacher. But, you know, the really great journalists are preachers. They're concerned primarily with truth, not with news, like a good preacher. And that's why the really great journalists are always management problems, because their loyalty is not to the institution or to their own career, but to their viewer, their listener, or their reader. And that's why I really like journalists. I mean, I can't stand academics. The only people I socialize with are old newspaper reporters and actors, all of whom have great stories. They're both incredibly entertaining. And, you know, they have a kind of capacity, or they understand human nature, both its dark sides and its good sides. And underneath it all, they're, you know, whatever veneer they may sort of throw up, they're usually real, they're romantics.
Now, your book is fundamentally an analysis of American society. I mean, you do refer to some things outside the States, like the British version of Big Brother, for example. But I'm wondering, based on what you've observed, how are other societies different than what's happening in your society right
now?
Well,
Canada is always a mystery to me, because we do everything wrong, and then 10 years later, Canada follows our example. America's peculiar in the sense that it's an imperium. It's an imperial power. So it has peculiar characteristics of its own that are not shared by other disintegrating societies. It has the hubris of imperial power, the blindness of imperial power. I don't know that it's in the DNA of other peoples to believe that they have a right to go storming around the world and using their military to make people conform to how they think people should live. I think that is an American disease.
It's clear that you're writing about a society that you deeply love, and there's a strong sense of sadness in your work.
Well, of course, because, you know, I have watched these forces, and I'm not in any way blind to the many imperfections and injustices within American society, but I've watched these people kill my country, or let's say these forces kill my country. And, you know, we my family's been here since 1633. We've been here a long time. And of course, it's sad, and it's sad because I have children, and I wonder what kind of a world we're going to leave them. I mean, I have a three-year-old, and his favorite book is Out of the Blue, and he flips through the pages on the morning looking at great narwhals and squids. And I know that if there's no radical reorientation of our relationship with the ecosystem within his lifetime, every single one of those creatures will be dead. How can I not be sad?
I'm curious, given your background, your seminary training, how you see books and social critiques like yours fitting in with the long tradition of prophets.
Well, I don't like the word prophet. Truth, you know, the truth is something that if you speak it, I mean, certainly a good preacher learns that, is uncomfortable, if not unpalatable, for many who hear you. And I had a great homiletics or preaching professor at Harvard named Christopher Stendahl, who used to tell us that, you know, if everybody walked out of the church on Sunday morning and thought everything you said was great, then you'd failed. But if six or seven people were struck deeply by your words, then you had succeeded. I gave a commencement address at Rockford College in 2003 where I was booed off of the stage, 1,000 people. And when it was over, I got maybe a half dozen letters from students who thanked me for I was denouncing the Iraq War. And I even had friends of mine said, well, you should have moderated your message. And I said, no, I was only speaking to those six people.
Now, your book has approximately 190 pages of pretty bleak stuff, and then at the end, about 3 pages of hopeful stuff. Is that, do you think that's a fair representation of the ratio between collapse and hope?
Well, but hope not in a traditional sense. I mean, it's hope built around the belief that no matter what happens, the capacity to love, the capacity for empathy and compassion can never be obliterated. And that doesn't mean that the nation state or the imperium survives, or that even we as distinct individuals survive. But again, I think that goes back to my roots as somebody who comes out of a religious tradition and a seminary, because those are the forces of the divine. And that what controls our lives now are systems of death. That's what corporations are. They're in theological terms, they're systems of death. And no matter how much destruction they can unleash, they can't ever extinguish love. And so that gives me hope, but not hope that somehow we're going to resurrect the nation or rebuild the consumer society or reinvigorate the imperium. That's not hope.
I'm wondering, in your personal journey, if there were moments, was there a particular moment when you decided reporting on all of this isn't enough anymore? I have to say more, I have to do more, I have to be out there more.
No, because I always was very careful about where I put myself as a reporter. I was never in Washington. I was in El Salvador covering the war. I was in Gaza or the southern Sudan or Algeria or Sarajevo. And these were jobs that most reporters didn't want. I put myself in positions where I was standing with victims of horrendous repression and writing about their experiences. So I understood, I think, early on that the closer you get physically to centers of power, the more, as a journalist, you're forced to compromise. That one can speak quite honestly if they're covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. But to bring that same kind of honesty or critique to the Bush administration is politically seen as so politically charged that you're pushed out of the fraternity, as I was. But I was quite open about my critiques of Milosevic. What got me in trouble was using the same kind of honesty to talk about George W. Bush.
When it comes to religion, your book really only mentions televangelists and the militant Christian right. I'm wondering what role you see the rest of organized religion playing in all of this.
Well, the theologian Paul Tillich had a great line. He said, every institution, including the church, is inherently demonic. Churches are human institutions that inevitably serve their own power. And yet, I think that the values of that Christian anarchism that my father came out of, Dorothy Day, the Berrigans, King, even, I hold fast to, that we're called to do the good, or at least the good insofar as we can determine the good. And then we have to let it go. The Buddhists call it karma, but we don't know. I think faith is the belief that it goes somewhere. But we don't know where it goes. We have moral imperatives that we have to abide by. And those moral imperatives require us to stand up and denounce injustice and discrimination and violence. And we're not rewarded for virtue. It's not good for our careers. And I think one is sustained by the belief that acts of virtue or integrity are their own reward. And this was certainly evidenced in my father's life, who was a very outspoken supporter of the civil rights movement at a time when Martin Luther King was one of the most hated men in America. He was a veteran of World War II. He'd been a sergeant in North Africa. He denounced the Vietnam War. And then he was very active in the gay rights movement. And I think perhaps for the institutional church, his stand on gay issues was, well, this is the 1970s, was the most controversial. And he became a kind of pariah. And yet I think I think finally you can't teach morality. You carry out moral acts. And then my father died in 1995. But I mean, these people stand as invisible witnesses. When I was called into the New York Times and given a written reprimand for speaking out against the war in Iraq, and I'd been there 15 years, I'd been part of the team that had won the Pulitzer the year before, I realized that I had a choice. I could pay fealty to my career and muzzle myself, but to do so would be to betray my father, and I couldn't do that. And I remember walking out of the building. I'm not going to pretend it was an easy day. I didn't have any money. Didn't know what I was going to do. I was certainly burned. I was never going to get another media job. But I remember distinctly thinking that what my father gave me was freedom. I didn't need the New York Times or anyone else to tell me who I was.
Chris Hedges, author of Empire of Illusion, published by Vintage Canada. He was interviewed by Jim Brown of CBC Calgary. Empire of Illusion was produced for Ideas by Jim Brown and Dave Riddell. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy.